Welcome to ASHTO Resource Q&A. We're taking time to discuss construction materials, testing, and inspection with people in the know, from exploring testing problems and solutions to laboratory best practices and quality management. We're covering topics important to you. Now, here's our host, Brian Johnson.
Today on the podcast, I've got a guest with us today. It's Jim Bibler, the Technical Development Manager from Gilson Company, Inc. Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, let's start just with some basic information about Gilson, the company you work for. What exactly does Gilson do?
We manufacture, distribute construction materials equipment first and foremost, but we really try to help solve customers' problems in qualifying their construction materials, aggregate, asphalt, concrete, soil. So ultimately, that's our goal, is to try to resolve those problems. We do that through manufacturing and distributing the products.
So Jim, what are the common pieces of, or most common pieces of equipment that Gilson sells and provides customer support for?
I'm going to start with aggregate equipment, primarily because that's where we got our start with the larger testing screen. And then we've got the smaller sieve shakers themselves, splitters, LA abrasion. Those are our core products that we started with back in the 30s and 40s. And then from that, it was just a demand for other things, construction materials testing-wise. But mostly aggregate equipment is where we get most of our questions for the maintenance and the upkeep of that equipment.
Yeah, sometimes when we talk to people, and this goes for anything in any industry, you always get the, they don't make them like they used to kind of comments. Mm-hmm. What kind of changes have taken place in equipment manufacturing in this industry? And do you think things are getting better or worse from your perspective?
I could go either way on that. Here's the thing. I think we've had some changes in the quality of steel and some individual components or the raw materials maybe have taken a small dip. But then you add into it the fact that we've added the automation with the CNC mills and the lathes. All the components have become more dimensionally accurate. All the parts are dimensionally accurate. So ultimately, that should create higher quality of product for the customer. However, I really do believe that some of those raw materials that influence that could be affecting that overall perception, I suppose. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, you are really involved in committee activities within ASTM and ASHTO, and so are some of the other Gilson employees. But you don't seem to approach it from the perspective of, hey, let's try to make that standard match what products we're selling. And I appreciate that about Gilson and the staff there, as well as there's some other companies that do the same thing. But since it seems like selling is not the main objective there, what is the strategy there for being so involved in standards development? Why is it so important to you?
Well, Ben Backus started in our technical department and had 20 years lab experience. Jen Hanley had 8 years lab experience. I had 17 years lab experience. So inherently, we're just kind of aware of not only the procedures, but the procedure process, the importance of the quality, the condition and the calibration of the equipment used. And we kind of understand how all that kind of ties in and affects the results of the test. So the only way that we can really make sure that we stay on that path of supplying quality equipment that meets all those qualifications is to completely understand procedures. And the only way to do that is to attend ASHTO Committee on Materials and Pavements, ASTM, stay involved in TRB, the Resource Technical Exchange. I mean, those are just key components of us keeping our hand on the pulse of what's going on in the industry so that we can supply the best product we can.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I imagine when you're at those meetings, you're finding out, you know, the latest news and information, as well as what kind of issues other people are running into. But what kind of questions do you get from your customers the most? I imagine that they've got questions about maybe some things that you may not be expected to be able to answer that are more specific to the materials that they're testing, but Do they ask those kind of questions, or is it mainly just about the equipment itself?
They do ask those questions. They ask what equipment they need for the procedures. They ask how to run the procedure. They don't understand a certain part of the procedure, and they want clarification on that. Things that aren't identified in the procedure, they'll ask, how often should I calibrate my sieves? You know, how do I know if they're calibrated? Do I send them back? I've got an old piece of equipment that's 20 years old. Do you have parts for that? You know, or this is the fee angle I'm getting on my test result. How can this be for this material? So, you know, we do have to kind of understand material properties and all that stuff. I answer those questions a little hesitantly because I don't want to get into the design or the prediction of how a material is going to act in the field. But we do try to do our best to kind of steer them towards good information.
Yeah, now I'd like you to answer that one question about the old parts. Somebody has really old equipment, I mean, do you guys have a stockpile of old parts?
Yeah, for items like testing screens and old shakers, we do have an inventory of parts that we can supply them with. It's easier to repair something that's old. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, you can unscrew a part, screw a new part back in. How much has computer-operated equipment changed the way you guys operate? Are you guys replacing motherboards instead of gears and springs now?
Yeah, we do supply motherboards and other computer-controlled components for some of the equipment. There's still a lot of spring-wound timers out there.
People always ask about that timer requirement in R18, and that's why it exists, is because of those spring timers that were so prevalent back in the day. I like to revisit that issue regularly and see, okay, is it time to stop making people standardize their quartz timers? Because usually it's more of a test of how fast their reflexes are.
Right.
They can start and stop those timers. But if they have a mechanical timer, it could be pretty far off.
I agree. Yeah. We encourage using the digital timers whenever we can.
Yeah, now let's get into sieves and sieving sufficiency, because I think that's one of the main things that we want to talk about today. Now, obviously, Gilson sells a lot of sieves and shakers. We see the 8-inch sieves, the 12-inch sieves, well, even sometimes the little 4-inch sieves, and those are diameters for those of you listening. Can all those sieves, well, I guess not the 4-inch one, but can all those other sieves be used for the same purpose?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, we have recommendations where we'll try to guide the customer to maximum size to be used on a particular sieve and a particular shaker. Obviously, sieve height has something to do with it. If you have a 2-inch sieve and you only have an inch and a half above the top of the cloth, then it would obviously come in contact with the other cloth above it. That's not going to work out very well. That's a situation where you would encourage somebody to go to a larger screen shaker. And then the same right down to, you might have that problem with a 1-inch particle where you have multiple particles laying on top of each other. We might encourage them to use a 12-inch diameter sieve, which has a little taller frame as opposed to the 8-inch diameter sieve. You also see intermediate height sieves, half height sieves, that comes into play. Those are fine for your smaller number 4 materials and below. But really, I wouldn't encourage folks to use those on the larger particles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've got those deep well 200 sieves for wash.
Yep.
Right, those exist too. But I think the biggest confusion that I've heard about in the industry is that transition between the 12-inch diameter round sieves and the big tray sieves that go in the totally different kind of shaker. Can you talk about some of the issues related to those?
So the larger shakers really are designed for anything that's 2.5 inches to about a number 4, number 8. People do use them down all the way down to a number 200, but it's rarely for qualifying grain sizes down to that size. We would recommend that a customer use that anytime they're using a bulk material that has a top size of 2 inches. For the 12-inch diameter, while it might handle a 2-inch particle, it's not going to handle 8 2-inch particles. So I guess at that point, if you're talking about having 1 2-inch particle that you can easily scalp out of your sieving process and weigh it separately, 12-inch diameter sieve might be all right in that case, but I would not be recommending it for anything over really about an inch and a half in top size.
Yeah. Another issue that we hear about with those big tray sieves is when people try to check their sieving sufficiency with that, because if you look at the standards, you've got specific practice that's described and defined and people have to adhere to, where you're using an 8-inch round sieve and tapping it so many times, rotating it, tapping it to check it out. How in the world are you supposed to do that for the big tray sieves when you've got so much material on those and then transfer it to an 8-inch sieve? What do you recommend when people call? I imagine that's a common question. Do you get that one?
Yes, quite often. As a matter of fact, often enough that I actually call that the nemesis of the construction materials particle size problems. And you're right, it's because we're trying to qualify every single tray, and some trays just have such a large amount of material on it that you have to transfer it from your screen shaker to your 8-inch diameter sieve. I mean, a 12-inch diameter sieve is really hard to do hand sieving with. So most of them move that over to an 8-inch diameter sieve, and now your sieve area is so much smaller. You have the opportunity to lose material between the transfer process. You have to run multiple tests sometimes, which means that even if you have a couple particles that get stuck in the 8-inch sieve and you don't get them out, that's transferred to the next sieving sample. Those are some real problems with the transferring of the material. You also have sieve opening tolerances in M92 and E11. And while the tolerances I would call relatively tight, they do allow for different size openings. And those different size openings can yield, you know, a different percent retained. That gives the appearance of inefficient mechanical shaking, in my mind.
I agree, and I hope people caught that as they were listening, but I want to explore that one a little bit more, because I think that's probably the biggest issue that people have, is that they're expecting those screen openings to be exactly the same between the tray and the 8-inch diameter sieve. But I mean, if you look at those, if you just look at the manufactured screens that you have between those two, you see a really thin diameter wire mesh on the 8-inch one compared to that in the tray. So it seems unreasonable to expect those to be the same, because they're probably coming off a different manufacturing process. Is that correct?
It's all woven the same, but they're seldom from the same bolt of cloth.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So they weave this cloth in large quantities, and then, you know, you can match a sieve to a screen tray. And we have had customers request that before. But even then, you still have the potential for two different size openings, both meeting the M92 or E11 requirements. So it's not foolproof, even to get those matched up.
Oh, so the general process, so the manufacturing process, you are using sometimes the same screen?
Exactly, yeah.
On the tray and the 8-inch. Oh, no kidding.
Yep.
Wow. So I didn't realize that, because it seemed like from the ones I've seen, and maybe it's because of the age of the tray sieves that I've seen, where they look ostensibly different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you do have that, because I think that customers look at those screen trays and they do not inspect those or have them certified or verified as frequently as they do the round ones. I don't know why that is, but they don't do it.
Hmm.
We do offer that calibration and certification process to E11 for both the screen trays and the round sieves, but I can tell you that the round sieves are verified tremendously more often than the screen trays.
Okay, so that's interesting too, because I think what happens a lot of times is people get if I buy a new sieve, I get it and it has a slip of paper that says it's in conformance with E11, but that's not a calibration record with individual measurements, but you do offer a calibration service where you actually will check an individual sieve screen and a sieve in accordance with the 11?
Yes, all of them are manufactured according to that main E11 specification or M92 specification, where we certify that all the cloth is made the cloth is measured and then it's cut and placed in sieves. We do offer the service of actually measuring the certain number of openings based on the two different levels that ASTM the 11 have as a service, which actually measures the cloth inside the frame of the sieve, be it the tray or the 8-inch diameter or 12-inch diameter sieve. We also do the 3-inch diameters. We also supply some mesh that's in accordance with E161, which is an electroform mesh, which is more accurate, but those are expensive, and we sell those primarily to pharmaceutical industries or paint powder pigment industries, industries where it's a little more critical, whether something is 30 micron or 35 micron, let's say.
Thanks for mentioning the 3-inch, because I think I referred to those as 4-inch earlier. I appreciate that clarification. People are going to start asking for 4-inch diameter sieves. Do you guys sell 4-inch diameter sieves?
Not if I can avoid it.
Okay, that's good. So don't start asking Jim for 4-inch diameter sieves. That was just a mistake I made earlier.
We do sell a lot of 3-inch. A lot of 3-inch, though.
Yeah.
I have a question. I'm going to just jump in here. You said you calibrate the sieves. Like, how do you fix it if it's wrong? Do you just have to replace it? Or, like, what's the actual act of calibrating it if it is out of spec?
It's actually not a calibration. It's actually a verification of size openings. Well, it's called calibration grade inside the E11 spec. It's really just a measurement of a certain number of openings. And the number of openings that are measured are based on the opening size of the sieve itself. And it just gives the customer a higher level of confidence in the particular openings on that sieve.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's really no changes that can be made. If a customer were to send in a sieve, if they were sending in an 8-inch sieve, 12-inch sieve to have recertified or re-verified, and it was out of spec, what we would do is we would not charge them for that verification process, but encourage them to buy a new sieve and then verify it, and then charge them for the new sieve and the verification rather than say, oh, well, this one's too old. And believe me, because of the use and the abuse of some of these sieves, they are out of spec. Even, you know, that's just the way it is. I mean, they take a lot of abuse, banging on the counter and banging on the frame, and just they're a little more sensitive than that.
They take a beating, but they hold up pretty darn well. I mean, you see some really old sieves in laboratories and they still look great, and you check them when you're an assessor, and most of the time they turn out looking pretty good. And yeah, as far as the terminology is concerned, in ASHTO R18, those are referred to as checks. I think I called it a calibration, which is like unbelievable for me to make that mistake.
I was really confused, and I'm like, maybe I'm misunderstanding everything. Like, maybe I'm just don't know, but I was very confused by that terminology confusion. So thank you for clarifying all of that. Thank you.
Well, that's part of E29 is where E11 falls. And they do use inspection and calibration a little differently than we'd use it in the D18 or D4, C1, C9 construction materials. But E11 does use that terminology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do call it a calibration grade sieve. And then they go through and they define, you know, what that calibration, what the level of confidence is if you'd use that calibration grade sieve. So, I mean, yes, it's confusing in use, you know, by us, but in other industries, and you'll find this throughout the world, is, you know, in other industries, it's perfectly acceptable and understanding. But, yeah, calibration, there's no changing it. Once the cloth is weaved, it is what it is.
Yeah. Now, you talked earlier about sometimes people call with questions about practices or procedures of how to use the equipment or test a specific thing. As far as that sieving sufficiency practice is concerned, does Gilson have any videos or any other information that people can have access to from your website other than what's already in a standard like ASTM C136?
We don't really. I've tried to crack that nut several times with many, many customers. To me, it comes back to you've got a lot of things that are influencing that test result and that verification process. We've touched a little bit on the sieve opening tolerances. We've touched a little bit on transferring the material from the large screen to the smaller diameter sieves. And another key component in that is the aggregate variability, particle shape, roundness, angularity, what I call near-sized particles, what are likely to be lodged in the cloth during the sitting process. You know, these are all factors in the sufficiency equation that are really difficult to take out. The fact that some of the materials are softer than the hardness of the cloth, I mean, stainless steel has a Mohs hardness of about 6.6, 6.8. That might be fine for your garnets and your silicas, but boy, you put limestone or dolomite in there and you're starting to abrade the material and it's going to start to reduce its particle size on its own during the process. So, you know, by that very definition, I'm running it longer, trying to get it to meet that 1%, and I'm actually degrading the material during the process. And I think, oh, that didn't work. It's still wrong. I'll put it in there longer. And then I abrade it more. And, you know, it's a factor. So if I had something to give the customer, and I do try to get them to do that, it's almost like the micro-Deval test, where I try to get them to come up with an aggregate that doesn't abrade, that isn't super angular, and they can put in there and run and say, my shaker needs to run 10 minutes in order to get it satisfactory particle size analysis. And I think that once we start qualifying it like that, and we just say, I'm going to run it 10 minutes, you know, I think that would be better. And even that's not going to work for all materials. I mean, that would work fine for round materials, but angular materials, yeah, maybe you need to do 12 minutes. We need to qualify the shakers separately, I believe, from the materials and the wire cloth or the sieve mesh somehow. Yeah.
And I think that concept has been covered in ASTM C1077 too, where they clarify that laboratories need to establish different shaking times for different aggregates, composition and shape, I think are some of the things that they might mention. But like you were talking about, it really is the composition is critical because of the hardness difference between the screens and the aggregate being shaken. If somebody has a really delicate aggregate that they are regularly running, are there any other kind of mesh sieves or screens out there that are softer, that are like more like a delicate cycle for the shakers?
Yeah, you know, we could change the amplitude of the shaker so that it was a little less violent. We have offered that to other industries, primarily seeds and foods that, you know, don't want that agitation that's inherent to the large shakers and the small shakers, where it's, you know, designed for 2.5 to between 2.5 and 2.8 specific gravity type materials.
Wow, I never really thought about changing the amplitude on a shaker. I imagine only certain models would be able to be tweaked that way. Is that correct?
It's actually something that we do at the time of order, where somebody will say, hey, I'm testing Kohl's, another one, where it's a lot lighter than some of the construction aggregates, where they want something a little less violent. And there's a low amplitude attachment for those shakers, the large shakers.
That is really interesting. I never considered that before. What other things do you think are the most questions not asked, but things that you want people to know about regarding sieves and shakers?
You know, from a manufacturer's perspective, you know, there's a lot of tolerances that are affecting the shaking process. That's the reason we try to get away from the hand shaking, in my opinion. One of the things that Gilson does and has done is we have a laboratory here and we go through and we test the processes and we adjust and we tweak until we come up with an amplitude and a characteristic that meets with the materials that our customers are using. And that's why I say, you know, 2.5 to 2.8 specific gravity, mineral aggregates is what most of our customers are using this for. So we've actually designed these to meet the criteria of what they're testing. And that's something that's difficult to repeat in a hand sieving process. The mechanical process requires a certain size motor, a certain size pulley, a certain size belt, connecting rods and bearings that all impart drive on this in a frequency that achieves what we're trying to do. And it's difficult to replicate or verify that by hand sieving. It's almost like measuring a length by caliper and then verifying it with a ruler, truthfully. Mm-hmm. But the placement of the motor, the size of the motor, the size of the pulleys, the cam, the hammers, I mean, all that stuff is specifically designed for the aggregate industry. And we verify it in our laboratory, and we don't make changes unless it's verified. we try to qualify all this, and that's why I invite you guys to come and see what we got at some point. We take it kind of serious.
Yeah.
And particle size is our business, really.
I appreciate that. I'd love to check it out. As far as where technology is taking us these days, what kind of changes do you see coming down the road for Gilson as far as manufacturing or what kind of new products are you selling?
Most of the new products are in the soil industry for us and some of the asphalt products. So we do some development in that arena. We also have a couple of exciting new products that hopefully will be hitting the website here in the next month or so that are concrete related, which hopefully will, you know, make our customers happy. I think just improvements, you know, improvements on things that we see give our customers headaches. Just another way for us to resolve their problems and improve their ability to qualify their products, I think, is our mainstay right now is just trying to help our customers improve what they're doing and the procedures and that kind of thing.
All right. That sounds good. Kim, before we wrap it up, I always have to ask you, you've been listening to me babble on with my questions and listen to some of the things Jim said. What I always miss things. What did I miss today?
I don't know if you missed anything. I'm not a technical person, so I'm not in the laboratory. So this could be a really easy and obvious question. When you're transferring material from your big sieve to a little sieve, how do you not lose material? Like, I'm very confused by that process.
Yeah, I've done thousands of sieves over the course of my life, and I can tell you that it's almost impossible not to lose some fraction of material. You try to limit it, but it's difficult to limit. I mean, you can turn it over in a pan. You can turn it over on a piece of butcher paper and then put the butcher paper in a smaller sieve. I mean, there are ways of limiting it, but I don't know if there are ways of eliminating it.
Yeah. Okay. That's, I was just trying to like picture that process in my head, and I'm just like, I don't understand how that you can do that. So thank you for clarifying. I could probably have also just gone into our laboratory in the back and see someone try to do it as well. But I just thought I'd ask.
No, it's a good question, and it's not an easy process. I can assure you that your question is something that has probably come across the desk of every lab manager that's trying to meet this specification. Is the technician's going to walk in there scratching his head? Okay, you want me to put this in here, and how am I supposed to do that? So yeah. Good question.
And another question that was just floating around in my head as we were talking. I'm picturing like the bigger sieves are square or rectangle, correct?
Yeah, rectangular.
And then the hand sieves I've seen are round.
Yep.
So is there a pros and cons, benefits, not for having corners versus round edges on the sieve? Like, does that change the testing? Does that change the material that falls through? Like, or did I just open another can of worms and we don't need to talk about that now?
No, I don't. We could talk about it. I know that there are some fractionated openings around the perimeter or that could be eliminated. And we do some of that with the screen trays using some material that goes around the outside to kind of cover those up.
Thanks. That's all I had. I think you covered everything else, Brian, for the most part. Those were just kind of, as you were talking, I was just like, oh, I wonder about this and I wonder about that. So.
Yeah, there's a pizza place around here that says that their pizzas are square because they don't cut corners. If Gilson ever went to an all square rectangular shape method, you may want to talk to those pizza people about.
May want to employ that marketing. Like that's that. Nice. I like that.
Yeah, it's pretty good. if anybody wants to know more about Gilson and their products and services, where can they find more information?
I mean, our website has got a lot of information on sieve shakers. We include blogs, product descriptions, videos, and we have a tech support email on there. If they don't see something that they'd like to see, we certainly encourage people to request that, and we put it on our docket and try to get to it as quick as we can. I guess that would be the most useful resource, would be that. We also have ASTM publication for sieving that we offer. We've got the aggregates handbook that we also offer that gives us a lot of detail on how to process materials, how to split materials. So that's a great resource. And of course, the ASTM and ASTRO method themselves are just a great resource for anybody trying to determine particle size or asphalt components, concrete components, soil. I mean, really, those procedures will give them a lot of information as well.
Yeah, now if people want to reach out to you directly because of some of the interesting insights you provided and they want a little bit more detail, can they email you directly?
Oh, yeah. Yep. My email is jbibbler@gilsonco.com, and I'd be happy to, you know, try to answer any questions that we didn't cover today.
My experience, though, is that no one ever emails the podcast at ashtonresource.org email address, so I'm not sure you're going to get much.
Oh, gosh. Okay, well, shoot.
Yeah, but I really appreciate your time today, Jim. Thanks. I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure other people listening did, too. So thank you for your time today.
Well, I appreciate you guys giving myself and Gilson the opportunity to speak on this. And certainly, if there's something else that needs clarified, reach out.
All right. Thanks. Sounds good.
Thanks for listening to ASHTO Resource Q&A. If you'd like to be a guest or just submit a question, send us an email at podcast@ashtoresource.org or call Brian at 240-436-4820. For other news and related content, check out ASHTO Resource's Twitter feed or go to ashtoresource.org.